Hey, Houston, how are you? It's Mr. McKinney with Mr. McKinney's Historic Houston, reminding you about the show we have this Friday, March 15th, 8 o'clock, right here on 90.1 KPFT. We're celebrating Women's History Month, and we're excited because we have with us two amazing ladies on the show this week. We have with us Jessica Lockheed. Dr. Jessica Lockheed is going to be joining us on the show. She is a professional working over at St. John's and also working in the arts, so we're looking forward to that. And Laura Woods. We've got with us Houston's own Laura Woods, native Houstonian, legendary fundraising diva herself. She's worked for such important nonprofits as the Houston Grand Opera, the Alley Theater, and Director Development for the Heritage Society at Sam Houston Park, near and dear to my heart. So do not miss out this Friday, March 15th, 8 p.m., right here on the Houston Hour with Mr. McKinney and Heidi Vaughn, only on 90.1 KPFT.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them, right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Keen, backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, we bring you guest storytellers every week who'll take us on magical journeys through their stories before landing us safely back into the present. Today, we have a new first-time guest on our show. Her name is Amy Wineland Daughters. She's an author and humorist, and I stumbled across one of her books called You Cannot Mess This Up. And I enjoyed it, and I found out Amy's a local writer from right here in the Houston area. So we invited her on today's show to hear some stories from a couple of her books. And here's a little more about Amy. Amy is a native Houstonian who's been a freelance writer for over a decade. Amy's also a keynote speaker, a letter writer, satirist, sports journalist, and the author of two books, Dear Dana and You Cannot Mess This Up. Hey, Amy, thanks so much for being our guest here on So What's Your Story?
I'm super excited to be here. Thanks, Eric. Well, my story is I got into writing kind of by accident. I got a business degree from Texas Tech. I worked in purchasing in Houston for about 15 years. I grew up outside of Houston. And then my husband's job moved us to the UK. And for 3 years, and all of a sudden we get relocated. I don't have a work visa. He's off to work, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with myself. So I started taking history classes at the University of Birmingham in England. And I'd always written on the side since I was a kid. I was the person at home who would, I mean, at work, I'd read my emails and crack myself up and think I was hilarious or think it was profound what I said in my email about Chardonnay. And so when I I got stuck. Somebody had asked me to write something when I was over in England. So I wrote it and they paid me. And I was like, wait, maybe there's a place here for me. And so I began to write. I began to sell stuff, you know, do a little freelance writing. There was no pressure because I wasn't working, nor was I supposed to be working at the time. Mm-hmm. We moved back to Texas. I'm pregnant with my second kid. And so I just ramped up the writing because I wasn't going back, you know, trying to get a job and try to ask for maternity leave at the same time. And I just created this space for myself. At the beginning, I mostly wrote about sports. I wrote about college football for the Bleacher Report for several years. I still write about football some. And I just created a little job for myself that I could do, especially as a mom with a young child. And then it blossomed into the books. And so I made a career out of writing without intending to.
Wow. Okay. So you weren't always a writer, it just kind of happened.
Right. I think I was always a writer in my heart. And I think we're all, you know, when we find it, I think it kind of found me. And I've been asked, like, what happens without England? I think I would have found it eventually, but I think it would have taken a lot longer. Right. So
England seems to be a good place to start writing. A lot of writers there. Hey, so let's talk first about your book. It's called You Cannot Mess This Up.
Right.
Now,
right.
I think agent sent me the PDF or something.
Right.
I start reading this, but I guess I should have read the subtitle a little more closely. It says, a true story that never happened. So this isn't strictly nonfiction memoir. Because I'm reading this thinking it's your memoir, and then all of a sudden, wait a minute, this is some kind of time travel stuff here.
Right. Well, part of it is a memoir, part of it's true, but it's wrapped. So it's a little bit of nonfiction wrapped in this tortilla of time travel of fiction.
Right.
So it is fiction. The book won an award, which I thought was very humorous. It won an award for time travel fiction. So as opposed to time travel nonfiction, as opposed to the true time travel. But so much of it is true and based on my memories, but the time travel element takes it into fiction and also gave me, you know, creative license to create dialogue and create scenes that weren't necessarily true. I could fabricate and mix the two things together.
Right. So now why don't you take us kind of through the whole story here, how it begins, and just give us the whole gist of this book.
Right. Well, the gist of the book is I am a mom and a writer, basically myself. And we lived in Dayton, Ohio for 12 years. So I'm living in Dayton, Ohio with my husband and my two kids. And I have to return to Houston for a meeting about my parents' estate. They were doing estate planning. So the narrative is I have to fly back before my family does for Thanksgiving, my kids and my husband, because this meeting with the lawyers has been moved up by a day. And so the premise is I get on a smaller private plane, like a little twin engine, with my husband's boss's wife, who is actually a pilot in real life. Uh-huh. And we have to fly from Dayton to Houston. And somewhere on that flight, I go back in time without knowing it to 1978. Mm-hmm. We land in Houston. We land outside of Houston at Hooks Airport, you know, near Tomball, Spring area, kind of northwest. We mm-hmm. land, and all of a sudden I figure out, wait a second, I've gone back in time. So basically I get dropped off at my parents' house in 1978. Oh. They think I'm a distant cousin from Ohio. And they think I'm in town seeing an editor, I'm a writer, and I don't have any place to go for Thanksgiving, and I'm stuck. So I get dropped off, and you know, and I get told by my time travel guide, the pilot, you got to go inside. I'll pick you up in 36 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine I get out of the car, I knock on the door. I'm 46 in the book, which is the same age as my parents in 1978. I knock on the door and I spend 36 hours staying with my parents, my siblings who are 1978 age, and my 10-year-old self with a bowl cut. And I'm a complete disaster, this little version of me. And so what I started out to write was this hilarious back in time book. That's what I intended to write. But what happened was when I wrote myself back to that time, saw my mother as an adult, you know, through an adult's eyes, saw my childhood self, saw my grandparents who had passed away by the time, you know, I wrote the book. I see all of this as a 46-year-old woman, well, that's there's so many feelings involved in that. So all of a sudden I've written a catharsis without even meaning to, having this 36-hour journey of discovery about memories, about how they're malleable, about how I would remember everything differently if I was 45, how I was uncomfortable with my 10-year-old self, but found all these incredible, wonderful things about myself and my 10-year-old self that I wish I still was. And it's such a relatable story, Eric, because we can all think about what we would do if we were the older and younger version of Amy in this story.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So did you write it mainly for entertainment? Because it also seems like some kind of a self-exploration, soul-searching, going back to your childhood, getting in touch with your inner child, that kind of a story.
Right. Well, and I didn't mean, I honestly did not mean, because that's not really how I operate, but that's, so many people have written me or contacted me and said, I related to it so much. It was like psychotherapy. And that was not the intentions. I'm a person who wants to make other people laugh. That's one of my, my goals in life. So I really did want to write. I'm fascinated with time travel, with like the Sears catalog, with metal detectors, with history. I read nonfiction and nostalgia. And that my whole intention was to really draw readers in to this nostalgic journey we could take together and then just make them laugh. Boom, boom, boom throughout the way. But as I said, as I alluded to before, it became this journey of self-exploration, and it absolutely did not mean to be. I was not trying to go for feelings.com, but I absolutely, and that added such depth to the story, where there's so much meaning, there is humor, there is nostalgia, but there's so much personal meaning. So I went into writing the book as one person, and then I came out a totally different person.
Wow. So it was kind of a self-therapy.
Right.
Process you went through.
Right. Non-intentionally.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit more specifically about the book. So you revisit your childhood. You are observing yourself when you're 10 years old in your family home in Tomball. And what happens? I remember there's Thanksgiving dinner and
right. Everything. Yeah. So I show up and, my dad answers the door and I see my dad as a young man, the same age as me. It's like all the pictures of your childhood come alive. I come into the house, the house looks way smaller than I remember it. These kids come running down the stairs and my I'm super uncomfortable with myself. My brother and sister, it just warms my heart to see. I have an older sister by 18 months and a younger brother by 2 years. And I'm like, oh my God, that's my people. Look at them. They're so young and I can still see their adult faces and their little faces. But then there's this little Amy and she's just prancing around and going completely nuts, and I'm like, and that was me. And in order to write those, I had spent many weekends away, kind of immersed in the family videos and photos. And I wrote myself exactly the way I felt and seeing myself in the videos, And so I see my mom, she comes into the picture. And then, I'm shown to my room and I come downstairs and Thanksgiving dinner is being prepared. And I realized that my mother's doing all of this work with no help and no one's even recognizing this as a mom. And so as a mom from 2014, I'm like, wait a second, what's this woman's doing it all by herself and she doesn't even have modern appliances, And so there's that connection and,
Yeah. Well, there's that aspect of the book too. Things have changed in the last 30 years.
Right.
Between what you said, 78 and 2014 is the time gap we're looking at here.
Right. Right. Yeah. And there's no electronic personal devices. Everyone's smoking a cigarette. The TV is crap. It's this huge cabinet TV with so all that's super relatable. And so then there's the underlying themes that, I've had a difficult relationship with my mother throughout my life, like many people have, but I see my mom as a completely different person as I'm watching her try to survive. And you think about as a woman in 1978, if mom would have had that same story about England, my mom would have never been encouraged to be a freelance writer, much less a sports writer or an author of a book. So I realized that my opportunities and my mom's life was much different than I perceived it as a 10-year-old kid. This woman was just trying to get by. I mean, she was living the dream with her Oldsmobile and her Ford LTD, but she was literally living a different life than I had ever given her credit for. And That was her favorite part of the book.
Did you see your mother differently after going through this?
Absolutely. 100%. And, you know, and her reading the book, that was her favorite parts of the book, was those nuggets of me sitting by and going, where's the dirty clothes? I know they're in this house somewhere. This woman is a badass because she's done Thanksgiving. She's had all these in-laws over. She survived all the negative comments. She survived the kids being completely out off the chain. You know, she's cleaned everything up. She's done it all herself and no one's given her any credit at all.
Yeah. You know, you and I are kind of a similar age, and I look back to those times too, and the women and my mother and all they did, so underappreciated. It's just boggles your mind when you think about it. But that seems to be a good, clear way to understand how it was, the way you kind of went back in time like that.
Right. You know, my children appreciated that in reading it. They were like, Mom, you know, now I kind of have an understanding. Well, not, they said it was also like watching a vintage movie. You know, they got an understanding of what not just my childhood was like, but what 1978 was like if you were 10 years old.
It brought back a lot of memories for me, the fashions and the TV shows, Mork and Mindy and all
that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then
part of the appeal of the book is the nostalgia.
Right. And then as Houstonians, you know, it's what a great thing to, you know, the blimp base is in there. And then the second day, we wake up after Thanksgiving and there's so many things that happen. But we wake up the next morning and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with me until she picks me back up. Mary, the pilot, picks me up at 5 o'clock the next day. So, you know, we go to Greens Point Mall and it's brand new. We show up and we do Christmas shopping at Greens Point Mall. And that's a great, as a Houstonian and as Houston listeners, it's just a great trip back in time for local people. I think everyone around the country that I've talked to, they relate to it. They look at Greens Point as their local mall in Minnesota. But for us, it's very specific.
Yeah. So is there much nonfiction? I mean, is this?
Right. Yeah. And so many people have asked, like, which part of it is real? And which part of the story is made up?
Right.
And almost every memory, the major points are all completely real. You know, but they're my childhood memories written into a book. So the dialogue is you know, obviously made up. And then the adult parts where there's a conversation between me and my grandparents and my parents after the kids leave the Thanksgiving table, that's manufactured. But there's truth rings through all of it because conversations with my mother, you know, things that I knew to be true, conversations with my parents that I weaved into the story. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of truth. There's no fabricated, like completely fabricated, made up stuff in the book other than the time travel, obviously.
Well, it is a memoir.
It is.
Time travel formatted memoir.
Right. It's like a backhanded, you know, backdoor memoir.
Yeah. It works. So you say your mother read it. What about you have siblings, I guess? Did anyone else read it and say, get any feedback from them on it?
Well, that's a great story, Eric, because I was, you know, it was my first book and it's super personal. You know, even though it was sold as fiction, everyone who knew me knew that it was my story. So I didn't realize that. And I know a lot of other authors can identify with this. It's a courageous thing to do. And I'm not blowing smoke up my own rear end. I'm just saying it's courageous to do something personal and put it into print though, because then it's out there for everyone to see. Well, so I get the book deal. I know it's going to be published and it's Christmas. So the book's coming out in June. It's Christmas. I come home from Ohio to Houston and my friends are like, Amy, you've got to give your family the book. You've got to let them read it. Oh, and they all knew I was written it. They knew it was done. And my dad had told me, look, you know, don't ask for our permission. Just, you know, just go ahead and do it, you know? And so I basically did the wimpy thing. I had it printed into binders and then I gave them to him the day I left up Houston for Ohio after Christmas and said, here you go. Merry Christmas. And then I left town. And so, cause I was afraid, you know, cause a lot of it was like the dialogue was fabricated. Was I going to upset someone? And a lot of the themes with my mother were difficult. And so my mom read it and she was nothing but love and grace. She read it and she enjoyed the parts, like I said, about her being highlighted as basically being the 70s suburban housewife warrior, you know, and how much I identified with that. my brother and sister thought it was great and hilarious because it was about our childhood. And there were so many scenes like we go upstairs and play the gong show. And they thought that was hilarious. And so many true memories were woven in for them. And then my dad, who I'm very close with, he was the last one to read it. And I don't think he read it till March or the end of February. And he sent me this great text and he said, you know, Amy, it was like I went back in time too. I thought you handled the delicate matters really well. Oh. I won't tell you how I felt about it because we don't talk about our feelings because that's one of the themes of the book. Yeah. And it was like, love, Dad. And then it was like dog emoji, dog emoji, dog emoji, because that's what he did when he texted. And, you know, he signs off to love, Dad. And the sad part of that story is the book went to print that next week after I got that text. And the next week he suddenly died. He passed away.
Oh, but, I didn't know about that.
But I mean, on one hand, that's terrible. But on the other hand, what a gift that my friends encouraged me to drop those binders in Houston and run out of town as fast as I could. But what a gift that I go on this book journey and my dad read my first book.
That's a good way to laugh. He read it and he liked it. He approved of it.
Right. And he was in it. And, you know, and so I've got that text on my phone. I'll never get rid of it. Because, you know, I've screenshotted it because that was, you can call it universe, you can call it God, whatever you want to call it. That was my gift from my dad for my career as an author. So.
Well, what made you decide to do that project to begin with? Did you have a purpose for it? A specific?
You know, it was just an idea, Eric, that had been kicking around in my head for years, and I just finally sat down and started writing it. So again, I didn't mean to go on. I'm really proud of the book because I think it has a lot of meaning, and it reminds us that, you know, no matter whether Oprah's going to interview us or we're going to be on Good Morning America, our stories matter. They matter enough to share with people. They matter enough to care about. You know, they matter. You know, they're important to us. And I think that's what I would like someone to get away from the book. You know, a reader takeaway, that and being entertained and then just completely enjoying the nostalgia.
Right. Yeah. Maybe it's something we should all do. Write a story about going back to our childhood and reliving it and seeing what things were really like. Yeah.
That would be I would recommend it. I mean, even if you don't do anything with it, I certainly didn't think it was ever going to become a real book. But yeah, I mean, it's such a worthwhile exercise. And for someone who's not into like feelings.com all the time, I mean, it was life-changing for me.
Yeah. Great. So do you have any favorite authors? Who do you read?
I love David McCullough. He wrote Truman and Mornings on Horseback. He's a history, you know, writer, but he tends to write more about social history. Like he writes it like a memoir, like a fiction book. And you know, all the details of someone's life, and he picks it apart and you get to know that person. It's like an intimate, you know, detail. Mm-hmm. He's probably my favorite author. Mm-hmm. But then I dabble around. I like Ken Follett, who wrote Pillars of the Earth. Just a super, I read everything that he's written. I like Stephen King. I'm not big into horror, but I liked his whole 1963 book about Kennedy's assassination.
Right. So would you describe yourself as kind of you're a humorist, would you say, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think a satirist or a humorist. I mean, that's always my angle. My angle is always about, can I somehow tie humor into this, you know, to the point where I have editors are like, okay, we get that you're funny, but we're gonna have to like cut part of the funny business. But you know, that's what I like.
Well, we're gonna take a little break from our show for station identification and to make a few announcements. I'm Eric Keene, and you're listening to So What's Your Story right here on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. And here's what's happening in the storytelling world in the Houston area. Our sponsor is the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild puts on numerous storytelling events and workshops throughout the year, and they feature online story swaps the fourth Tuesday of every month, and everyone is invited to those swaps. So to find out more about the Guild and what they do, go to HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're on that same website, you can find our program's webpage. Just click on the So What's Your Story link. It features archives from our radio show dating all the way back to the year 2008. And we're also on Facebook. Just go to the Facebook page called So What's Your Story and find out more about us there. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth holds monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live Midtown at 2600 Travis Street. Doors open at 7 p.m. and stories begin at 7:30. So be sure to check out the Moth. And now we're going to get back to this evening's storyteller, Amy Wineland Daughters.
Okay, and now we're going to get back to our guest today. We have Amy Wineland Daughters with us. Now, Amy, we talked about your book, the You Cannot Mess This Up. What about this other book? I think it's a newer one called Dear Dana. What's that about?
Well, right. That's a great story, Eric. You know, when You Cannot Mess This came out, You Cannot Mess This Up came out, I was basically, I like to tell the story, I was minding my own business, just doing my own thing, doing the writing thing. And I reconnected. I was on Facebook one day and I looked up this friend who I had gotten to know at Camp Olympia in Trinity, Texas. So north of Houston on Lake Livingston in 1986. Mm-hmm. So I just graduated from Klein Oak High School. We spent probably 6 weeks together at the summer camp as counselors. And I don't really remember what happened, except for we both have huge personalities and we think we're funny and we probably bonded over that. So 1986, so we speed forward like 30 something years. Her name pops up in my head. I'm like, oh, I'll look her up on Facebook. There she is. I friend request her. She accepts my friend, you know, request. Now we're friends, you know, virtually, me and Dana. So I immediately go and look at her profile because that's what you do. And I realize she has five kids. She lives in Louisiana. She has five kids, four daughters. The youngest kid is the only boy. His name is Parker, and he's at St. Jude in Memphis fighting cancer.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah. So immediately as a mom, as a human being, I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. But I have not talked to this person in 30 years, and I've never met this kid.
So you didn't know about that until then.
Right. I had no idea because I had no contact with her. And I don't, we have mutual friends since, but at the time we weren't connected like via a web of people. So I immediately start following along with the story. She starts showing up on my news feed. Then, you know, he goes through a really bad time. She starts asking people to pray. I kind of like to pray. So I'm like, oh, I'll pray for her. So I pray a little bit and I follow along. Like I said, he goes through a rough time. Then he goes into remission. So she kind of goes on the back burner, except for I'm still watching her feed. She's an LSU fan. She likes college football too. So I like that. He goes back to Louisiana. He's getting treatment there. And at the end of, I think it was 2015, 2016, the tone of her posts start to shift on Facebook. We still had no direct contact. And it looks like Parker is sick again. Oh, so boy. Parker goes back to St. Jude in Memphis and it's not good. So she posts and says, we're going back. We're going to have to be in treatment for another year. It's going to be really rough. I'm like, wow, man, that's rough. Like anybody would think, but I kind of knew I was overfeeling it. And I like to tell this story, like different DEFCON levels of craziness. So she posts that and I'm like, and it wasn't like, I just thought, here's an idea. It was like, I got struck by lightning. I was like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start writing them letters at the Ronald McDonald House because I knew that's where she was staying in Memphis. Such little cards of support. And this, despite the fact I haven't seen this woman in 30 something years, I've never met the kid. You know,
you're
like
talking about regular physical letters you write with your hand and you send
right.
in the mail with a
right.
stamp. Like
and
the
I
old
haven't,
days.
Right. And I haven't sent a letter to anyone in outside of a Christmas card in 25 years. It's not like I was this woman.
Nobody has.
Yeah. Like I was the letter writer and look what I was going to do. And so I had this, I was with the Bleacher Report at the time. So I had this schedule, like they'd send me an assignment on Tuesday for Wednesday for Thursday, whatever. There was three articles a week. So I made her my Sunday for Monday, Dana and Parker. So I started writing them on Sundays and then I would mail it Monday morning. I mean, I didn't have stamps or anything. And so I start writing the two of them just totally randomly. Like, I'm thinking about you. I'm praying for you. Like, we're here with you, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so this goes on for about 6, 8, 10 weeks. And then I look on Facebook and Parker and there's no good words for this. Parker passes away at age 15.
Oh no.
So he loses the fight. And I know it has nothing to do with me, Eric, but I'm like, again, I'm kind of overfeeling it. I'm like, I felt invested in the story. Mm. And though, even though I shouldn't have at all. So next level of craziness, I'm like, well, what do I do? And then I sat around and thought about it for about a week. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to start writing her. And it was just a gut instinct. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And so then I stalk her husband's, because where am I going to write her? She went back home. But I don't even know what town in Louisiana, South Louisiana, she lives in. So I stalk her husband. I find his work address. And I just start sending the cards. They're like some insane woman. And then the letters get longer. I just start writing about my life. I mean, what do you write about? You know, and so I just.
Responding to these letters, or you just kept writing?
Well, about 4 months, I don't know, it was 2 or 3 months, she sent me a Facebook message and said, and my friends thought this was hilarious, like, here's my home address. They called it the cease and desist, like, quit sending cards to my husband's office. Yeah. So then I have the home address. I'm like, So she said in the Facebook message, you don't know what the cards mean to me. I'm like, so that's my go ahead. Yeah. And so then I keep writing her. And then several months later, I go to my mailbox. I'm living in Ohio at the time. I open it up. It's my birthday. I pull the envelope out, and it is a letter from this woman, Dana.
Oh, wow.
It's like a 6-page letter. And so this kicks off 2 years of us communicating just through the mail. Handwritten letters. That's it. And so just like old school days.
Yeah,
pen pals. That's what we were, pen pals. And so I share about my life. Looking out from the outside in, I write about my marriage, my kids, my job, my mother, my mother-in-law. And I'm getting this perspective that I wouldn't have got any other way, because I'm looking at my life from the outside in. She is writing to me about her life and her grief. She is telling me, and she told me after the fact that, you know, she's doing life with 4 daughters and a husband who've all lost this kid. Mm-hmm. And so if she walks into a room and everybody's having a decent day, she's not going to be like, guys, this is crap. I'm about to lose it. She would write me. She doesn't even know me. So I'm the deposit for her grief. And then when the letters are crossing, and we forget about this in letter writing, it's beautiful because I don't know when or if she's ever reading my words. She doesn't know when or if I'm reading her words. So no one feels compelled to respond to any specific comment on anybody's part.
Yeah, and the other, it's not this instant message going back and forth. You have hours and days and even weeks to digest these exchanges.
And I find myself walking around letting her words marinate in my head. And I don't even know this person. And then we develop this unbelievable trust, this intimate trust. Like we told each other stuff we weren't telling other people, and we didn't even know each other. And the other beautiful thing was, Eric, like I didn't know how she voted. I didn't know what religion. I knew she believed in God because she asked people to pray, but I didn't know if she was a Methodist, Episcopal, Jewish, Catholic. I didn't know if she was, and it didn't matter. None of that mattered. All that mattered was here was this friend from 1986 was desperately hurting. And for her, here was this friend from 1986 who was loud, who cared.
So Amy, do you think this communication, the method of handwriting letters like the old days, physical letters, do you think that made it different than if you would have just been texting and emailing her?
Oh, it completely, it blew up both our lives. She said her family would wait for the letter to come. They knew it would come on Wednesday or Thursday, and they would all wait. They would all read the letter because it meant something to them. And at the end of every letter, I would tell them how I was praying for them, how we were thinking of them, how I'd asked other people to think about them and pray about them. And so after about 6 to 8 months of this pen pal thing, I sat back and I was like, man, if my life can be blown up from this one Dana girl in Louisiana, guys, what else untapped goodness is in this list of random people on this Facebook thing? And so I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go DEFCON 5 crazy, and I'm going to put everyone's name in a box. I'm going to get some stationery made that says Amy Wineland Daughters, your Facebook friend, at the top. And I'm going to start writing all these people letters. And I never intended to finish. I journaled the whole thing. I never intended to do anything meaningful, but it was absolutely the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life.
So do you actually started writing letters, physical letters, to all your Facebook friends?
Right. I sat down, pulled the name out of the box every morning, and wrote that person a 2-page letter.
Wow.
And it took me 18 months.
See,
and
nobody writes letters anymore.
Eric, that's the beauty, because when people went to their mailbox and pulled those letters out, it was one of the most meaningful experiences of their life.
Right.
And because they were like, oh my God, they connected the dots of what I had to do. And the other beautiful thing was it forced me, like, if you're going to write a letter to somebody from seventh grade band, you're going to need to go look at their Facebook profile to figure out something to say. So over and over again, I was like, oh my God, I'm related to all these amazing people. Like, who have, like, if I would have written you, I'd be like, oh my God, Eric is doing this NPR show. I didn't even know that. I would have gone to listen to your show and said, Eric, I'm so proud of what you did and the difference you're making with these stories you're getting to tell. And I've seen your family now, and I know that you graduated from Northwestern, and I didn't know you had that achievement. And I'm not saying you did that. I'm saying that's the kind of stuff I got to say. And then I got to say stuff like, Eric, thank you for being there when my grandmother died. Or you remember when that guy picked on me from the tuba section and you stood up for me? I got to say thank you to people. I got to say, hey, I found out your kid's sick. I'm sorry, and I'm thinking about you.
Well, did this stimulate some response from that? Did you get physical letters back from other people then?
Oh my gosh, it was overwhelming. I had 75%.
You might have started something here.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do with the that's what I keynote speak about, is the letter writing.
Right.
That it's kind of become my calling without me even intending to get involved. But I was about 200, I guess I was halfway through the letters when I was like, you know, I'm going to write a book about this, not because I want to make $1 zillion. I mean, that'd be great. But because this story is it's just so unique and powerful, because the biggest takeaway from the letters is this. If you reach out to someone with nothing but goodwill online, I had so many people trying to figure out what my angle was in doing this, you know, and then if you respond in kind, that suddenly all those things that separate us, like how you voted, like what you believe in, like these specific things we require of each other at this point, you know, if you don't believe exactly what I believe, then we cannot even be connected. All that, though it still matters, it just suddenly starts to just dissipate. And
you know,
this
is something a sociologist should probably examine, because, like, you know, communication is so easy now with text and email. It's almost too easy.
Right.
But it takes work to write a letter.
It
seems like it sort of deepened your communication. I remember the days before the internet, there was no better feeling in the world than to go to your mailbox and see a letter from a friend.
Right.
And texts just aren't the same. And so, yeah, it's nice. You're bringing that back. That's super.
Right. And now you can multiply that feeling by 1,000. This is my experience just in the reaction to the letters. Because if you think about it, Eric, if you go to your mailbox and get a letter from a friend from high school, you're going to connect the dots at the amount of effort that took on their part. They would have had to find an envelope and some paper or a card. They would have had to written it down. Their hand would have hurt, because I have one friend say, I had to get my Aspa cream out when I wrote you back, which I thought Aspa cream was hilarious. Like, who even has Aspa cream? And then you had to find a stamp, and then you had to get in the car and go find a post office box and mail it. And they're going to feel like a literal rock star. And I realized that for 66 cents in about 15 minutes, we can unleash a lot of good on this world.
Wow. So you're still doing it? You're still writing letters like that?
Yeah, I'm not writing them to that degree, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
but
that's a lot. Yeah.
It's like adrenaline for me now. It's not just adrenaline. Like, it's a way I know I can make a difference. And I think the absolute best version of myself was myself during the 18 months of writing letters. So I still write Dana every Sunday. She still writes me back a couple of times. Like, she's texting me during the show, which is hilarious, because we're BFFs now, best friends. But every morning, Eric, I get up and write a small card to someone. And what I try to do is, you know, when I'm on social media, just like everyone else, I see things like somebody gets a teacher award, or somebody lost their mother, or somebody, I see somebody that, or somebody did something for me last week, you know, in terms of one of the books or for one of my kids. So I send a thank you note or a congratulations card or a condolence card. And every morning, it only takes me 15 minutes. I write somebody something.
Yeah. You know, it's a lost art, letter writing. So people see those, it probably freaks them out. A real letter.
Oh, they, you know, we went, Dana and I went on, we went on a 17 stop book tour after Dear Dana came out, and she went with me, and what an adventure we had.
That must have
And
been great.
yeah, and she, you know, and for her, she's honoring her son Parker, because so much of that story, because the book takes Dana and I's story and then weaves both letter writing stories together. And it's a very inspirational, feel good kind of book. And there's a lot of my faith involved in there, but really it's gauged towards anyone because the letters were to people from different faiths, different po political beliefs, and that's the whole point of this. But so we go on this book tour, and almost every stop we went on, Eric, somebody would come with their letter in pristine, their Facebook letter in pristine condition, like they were a rock star. And I had buttons made that said, "I received a Facebook letter." And people thought they were the business because they got one of these letters. And I would tell them what their number was. And every single case, those people would tell me, "I'm," and this is probably the biggest feedback from the Facebook Letter Project, "I'm going to save your letter in a special place for the rest of my life."
Wow.
We
That
all have
doesn't
the
sound.
power to do that, every single one of us.
Well, it's obviously making a difference. So you, I'm sure you've bolstered other friendships this way, more than just Dana, right?
Oh yeah, well, it's amazing what it did. I tell my husband, like, I feel like people hug me different because of the letters. I mean, I do feel like it's an intimacy, like we made a connection outside of all of this. Like it turned us into real people, you know. And I would sign every letter, "Your real life friend," you know, because that's what it was. It was like transforming people from these electronic creatures to this living flesh and blood, you know, marvelous yet messy, let's, you know, these real people. And the other thing, people would show up, especially still they show up, but like at all the book stuff, they showed up. But like my dad was in the hospital, like I told you, and he died quickly. But afterwards, all these people who showed up at the memorial service, and my brother and sister, because the letter writing was going on when my dad died. And my dad actually called it the great social experiment. But to your point about the sociologist, but my brother and sister would watch people come in, they're like, "Oh my God, it's the letter people. The letter people are coming," because the letter people felt compelled to come and be at my side during my worst day, because they were like, "She reached out to me. I mean something to her."
Wow. Yeah, you might have started something there. I'm starting to think about, I got like 500 Facebook friends, I think, but a lot of them are, I'm not sure I'd recognize them if I saw them on, it's like
Me neither.
a
Me
friend of
neither.
a friend of a friend,
Yeah, I did all those. I did
but
all
you
those
did
letters too.
all your Facebook friends? Every
Well,
single
not I have 900 and something now. I had 580 when I finished, and I got to the point at the very end. People were friend requesting me to get a letter, and I just had to cut it off at some point because
Oh,
it
I
was
bet.
people wanted their letter. But I no, I did, and the rule was, because I wrote myself a little set of rules, and the rule was I wrote the letter before. You know, I had to write everyone, and I wrote it before I got the address. I had all these rules, so I made sure I wrote all the letters and kept a copy of everything. And
Well,
it
what
was
kind of
just,
responses did you get from some of these other people? Some will think it's kind of crazy, or I bet that it's kind of a heartwarming thing, if you ask me.
oh, it over and over again, people were like, you know, and I told people I was writing all the. In my first paragraph, I told them I'm writing every single one of my Facebook friends. And I told them about Dana and Parker, my why, you know. And over again, people would be like, "Oh, you chose me. I've been selected." I was like, "No, I chose everyone." But that's how it made them feel. And then they shared so much with me, Eric. They felt like here was someone who was going to listen to what they had to say. It was overwhelming to the point that there was an element of guilt because there was no way I could keep up with all of this. But the important thing is we had the initial exchange.
I think a communications professor should study it. The producer of this show, Dr. Hank Rubicek, he's a communications professor. He's going to hear this, and I think he'll analyze it. There's something about writing letters, communicating that way, that it's different than just sending a quick text and emoji and so forth.
And then I think there's something, you know, the physicality of it. Like if you send me something, you know, we're old friends from six states away, you think about how beautiful it is to hold that. It's visceral. I can hold in my hand what you held in your hand. And then we think about handwriting and how that's a reflection on our personality. And you know, I can, I'm sure you can remember your parents' handwriting, your grandparents' handwriting. And we've lost that though. And I wrote, my older son was in high school when I wrote the letters, or high school, college, those ages. And so a lot of his friends, you know, on Facebook, I was friends through with his friends. So those those kids, that was the first letter they ever got. And I got two brothers. One lives in Minnesota now and one lives in Ohio. And these kids still write me, these boys, because we liked football, college football. But that was the first letter writing exchange they'd ever had. So well, I was able to write letters to younger people, older people. And the response was just off the charts.
Look at all these younger people that have never written a physical letter in their lives. That's weird.
Right.
And you mentioned the handwriting as individual. Yeah, it's not just a font. We all use the same fonts, but we all have our own handwriting.
Right.
So that individualizes it right there.
Right. And then you look back at social media and, if you're going to do a post or I'm going to do a post, we can make sure the spelling's right. We can make sure the picture's filtered. Well, in a handwritten letter, unless you're going to go back to the beginning and start over, it's like regular photography, film photography. You're going to have to accept the flaws, but you're also going to tell the reader of your letter that you're a regular human being that messes stuff up. And in this age of perfection, this is a comforting thing, Eric, because my handwriting is crappy and I'm not a great speller, even though I'm a writer. And so over and over again, they were going to have to decipher that, but there's something so human about that and something so comforting that I didn't filter it. It was a mess. The whole thing was a hot mess.
Yeah, but it's real.
Exactly. Exactly. Very real. And then, I found out over and over again, and it seems so simple and we know it, but I was reminded hundreds of times. I would write somebody whose profile looked perfect. Like they looked like they were, drinking champagne on a yacht and they looked perfect in a bathing suit. And then that person was the person who was going to write you back and say, I've just been diagnosed with, bipolar disease. My husband just divorced me. My wife just left me. And it reminded me over and over again that people are as delicate as we are. People's lives are as real as ours are, regardless of what we put. And just a humanity over and over again, it made me realize how real everyone else's life is, real as ours. And again, it doesn't matter how you voted. You can care about people on both sides of the aisle. And letters are such an easy way to connect because they're not intrusive either. Because if I send you a letter, I don't even know if you got it. So you don't feel compelled to reply. It gives you freedom.
This would be a good social experiment. If everybody started writing letters again, I think it would change the world, Amy.
Well, since the book came out, I've been in contact with so many people who are writing letters because of the book, because of hearing about our story. Maybe they didn't even read it. They just heard the story. And then that's where I was contacted to write a speech about it. So I've just started my journey. I gave my first speech in February in Ohio. And I talk about lettering. I talk about basically what we've talked about today in a speech format.
Super. Well, that's great. I love that idea. You get some good ideas. So you've had the book on the time travel and the book on writing all the Facebook friends' letter. You got any other projects in the works?
Well, I've got another idea for a project, but the speaking and, between the two books, I've stayed pretty busy, in the Dear Dana book, I continue to, so I'm trying to roll with that story. My mission right now is to share the letter writing with as many people as possible. And I still write a little bit about football, but then I do have another book project, but that's kind of in the wings at this point. I'll get back into that.
You don't want to tip anything off at this point.
No, because if I don't, it's a great idea and we'll see if I can get it to fruition. But if I get it to fruition, maybe we can talk again.
Okay, we'll set that aside maybe another day.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Oh, and also you mentioned earlier, Amy, that you're kind of a sports writer. Tell us about that. What do you write about?
Right. Well, my main gig in freelance writing has been college football for 8 or 9 years. This last season was the first season I'd taken off because Dear Dana took off. And so I kind of took a step back. But basically I got into when I told a story about when I came back from England, someone asked me to contribute a college football article to something. And that got the attraction of Bleacher Report. So I was a national columnist for college football for 5 or 6 years with the Bleacher Report. So I covered all 130 of the, what they call the football subdivision, the FBS teams, as a national columnist.
Well, that seems like it's kind of a male dominated field, isn't it? Still.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I got a lot of, especially, and it's really changed a lot in the 8 years that I've written about football. Because there's a lot more, females know, involved. But I did have a battle at the beginning, you know, because people, what, you know, would make all the, because it's an easy thing. Sports is such a passionate thing, whether it should be or not. People are very passionate about sports and about their teams. And so I was an easy target because, so on one hand, I think I got more work because I was a woman and, you know, I researched and I'm good about, I like statistics. And on the other hand, I was a target because I was a woman, you know?
So it was a double-edged sword.
Huh? Right, right. So one thing, you know, mom's cool because she's writing about the other sports, but the other thing is mom needs to get back in the kitchen, you know? And I got a lot of that from guys, but over time, I think the culture of that has changed. And the other thing I learned was, because I'm a numbers girl, is one way to defend myself was just to always reference where I got my numbers from. You know, and then you leave people no room for, like, if you're operating in the facts, there's a lot of opinion in sports and sparring about that is part of the fun,
that's,
you know,
the but smart if, way to do. Yeah. Back yourself but, up like that.
Yeah, yeah. But I learned to always back myself up and use reliable sources. And the other thing I learned, great lesson for writers, is that if you're going to write about numbers, if you're going to write is double and triple and quadruple, check your facts. And then I developed a group of readers who followed me because I was gonna, with some humor, report, you know, statistics that they could count on and trust. And that's what I got. And so I ended up as the books came out, I kind of took a step back from the Bleacher Report, and I spent 4 or 5 years analyzing college football schedules. And that doesn't sound like fun, but that's probably the most exciting thing you could do, because if college football, the schedules are not created equally. And it's this, you know, there's teams that with an easy schedule, teams with a harder schedule. And it's a great discussion point. It's a great thing to write about. Oh. And I was able to write about it. And again, I like my stuff to be, it's not foolproof. It's not 100%, but I developed a group of people who like numbers and accuracy as well. And, you know, that's who my follower base was with my later work. But
yeah,
that's kind of my,
it sounds kind of dry, the schedule. I can see what you mean. Yeah. There's probably a lot of controversies and scheduling.
And then people are scheduled 10 years out. So it's a good discussion point, and it's a good way to compare teams because it's a very uneven playing field. So that's, you know, and that's kind of my dream job when I was a kid. And some of this is in the first book. I loved sports, and I would sit on my floor in our house in Spring, Texas, and sort my baseball cards by like ERA and RBI. And that's in the book. Cause little girl was doing that with my Pro Football Digest? So I had Barbies and I had the Pro Football Digest and all the helmets and the helmet magnet board. But I've always been into numbers and I've always been in sports. And I really think if I could write about one thing other than letters, you know, and maybe humor, I would write about sports. Cause that's really my passion.
Right. Well, you're a very multifaceted writer, Amy.
Thank you, Eric.
Amy, I want to thank you for being here. Once again, your books are You Cannot Mess This Up is the time travel one, and Dear Dana is the Facebook friends letter writing.
Correct.
Right. They're both out on Amazon, I assume? Or
yep. Anywhere you can buy books, yep, you can get them on Amazon. And my website is amydaughters.com. And you can, you know, there's links there too. And plus, I'd love to connect with anyone who wants to talk letter writing or time travel.
Yeah. Yeah. Get some more letters. It's amydaughters.com. Just like sons and daughters, daughters.
Right.
Amydaughters.com. Gotcha.
Yep.
Well, thanks again, Amy. And good luck to you in all these projects. And keep doing what you're doing.
All right, Eric, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for letting me share my stories with your audience.
Thank you so much.
Well, that is our show for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed our guest, Amy Wineland Daughters, and her stories. And don't you dare move, because Living Art is up next with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson. Make 90.1 FM a part of your everyday life. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Well, it's all right. Waiting for
tell you everything. Sit around and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a diamond.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.